Blog Talk Radio.
Wandering around at all hours of the day and night, it's a pleasure. You found Masonic Effects, a place where we attempt to engage people in ideas, with the ideas and principles and the belief system of Freemasonry. I'm afraid today we're going to be looking more at some of the various dimensions of Masonry as a belief system, and as if it's a culture within a culture, but you decide that for yourself. This is the 6th of December, 2015. It's the 340th day of the year. That means there's 25 days left. We're coming very close to the winter solstice on the 21st of December, shortest day of the year. So I'm hoping in true paganist, pre-Christian, pre-Jewish, pre-Muslim traditions, reaching back to the root of all that we know today, to a time more complicated, perhaps. I want to start off the program today with it's a sentimental program today, I think. It always is, I hope. A little bit of the reading. I have some beautiful music today. We're stretching back to things that were the foundations of Masonry. And I've been reading lately about contemporary structures, comparing different cultures and belief systems in terms of both their provenance and their impact. One thing is abundantly clear. Countries and nations that have, I'm saying countries because borders are becoming a little more natural, a little more fluid, less politically artificial, as if there's anything else. We're now discovering humans able to travel and circle the entire globe. Yeah, a lot of people are able to do it, whether it's the middle class here in North America or weary travelers moving away from starvation and wars. This 6th day of December. This is a poem read by Mike Lee, and I think you're going to like it. I hope so.
I've chosen a poem by Charles Bukowski. For me, this poem is near the bone. It strikes a chord. It takes me back. And it brings a lump. Excuse me. Eulogy to a hell of a dame. Some dogs who sleep at night must dream of bones. And I remember your bones in flesh, and best in that dark green dress and those high-heeled, bright black shoes. You always cursed when you drank, your hair coming down. You wanted to explode out of what was holding you, rotten memories of a rotten past. And you finally got out by dying, leaving me with the rotten present. You've been dead 28 years. Yet I remember you better than any of the rest. You were the only one who understood the futility of the arrangement of life. All the others were only displeased with trivial segments, carped nonsensically about nonsense. Jane, you were killed by knowing too much. Here's a drink to your bones that this dog still dreams about.
He missed her. Obviously he missed her. This is the music of Pyotr Ilyich Tchaikovsky, Russian. It's fascinating, and it seems sort of creates a mood that we need here for our conversation today, tonight, this evening. Sit back and relax. Put something warm in your hand or warms you. Listen. Tell me what you think. Set a mood. A mood of contemplation. Why does this kind of music have an effect on us for so many hundreds of years? How do we explain this? How do we begin to explain this? It's not all that we have difficulty with, is it? In a way, Freemasonry is like life. The tenets of Freemasonry is time-proven. The strength of those tenets is how useful they are to travelers, those of us who move through time-space. How a good man lives, how to live as a good man, are skills of thought that are transferable into behavior. They assume our universal quest is to live together in understanding, active in the pursuit of the common good. skills like this take time to develop. But our patience, being Freemasonry, is unfathomable. We are prompted, knowing the ideal. How do we do this? The need of an ethical existence aids our stewardship and brief time on earth. All of this is quite transitory. Quite. Self-improvement isn't about finding acknowledgments to everything that we believe. If we fall into that caveat, then we're going to believe that it's fine there's ways of justifying murder. There's ways of tolerating. You know, one of the greatest sins, I think, cultural sins, is when people of different dimensions learn to tolerate the distress of other humans. When they can justify the fact that they are the source of the distress. Now, whether you find that a reason or change your focus a little bit and begin to think that there is a point where right and wrong exist in the same thought, it is wrong. Terribly naive, isn't it? Terribly naive to have that type of belief system. What Masonry requires, though, is that pause. I'm going to be giving a paper in a couple of days at a local lodge. And the topic will be around what it is, what we've become, how history has tricked us in a way. Let's say all of you are busy at a particular type of work and you've developed your skills over the years. Whether it's a good job or not, I hope it is a good job, but let's say it's irrelevant whether you have a good job, but it's more important that you're good at it. And let's say as you get together with your coworkers, your cronies, that the conversation is lively and it's animated, and a sense of goodwill, maybe conversation, bon ami, occurs every time you get together. Because as a group, you have a lot in common with Freemasonry. You think that it was thoughtful discussion that brought men together. Maybe coincidentally at first, but nevertheless, it occurred with enough frequency that the men began to, men and women, they wouldn't be necessarily pushing people out of their shelter or their room to have these private conversations. But let's say that it gravitated toward men on men, because not to exclude anyone, but simply a reflection of what they happen to be doing at the time. Oh, we're caught up in we still have very shallow arguments amongst ourselves. It embarrasses us, really, when we talk about the exclusionary provisions of our Constitution. No women allowed. It's not whether we agree with that or disagree. The conversation about it, the explanation is so embarrassingly shallow that it makes sense to try and understand this in its fullness. Not something that would come out of the mouth of a schoolboy. That's the reason. It only embarrasses men of our stature, or it should. You get together with your cronies and a good time follows. And over the years, these meetings went on behind closed doors, because, you know, if you're talking about things in an open environment, in public, you're likely to end up distracted by people who don't necessarily agree with the fundamental, that it is perfectly sensible for intelligent men to discuss things in their fullness, not necessarily agree, but that the discussion and exploration of an idea does not mean an endorsement. So whatever we would talk about, let's say the things that are challenging our culture now, same-sex marriage, for example, a person's right to take their own life when they're in uncontrollable pain. There's a whole list of these types of things. Resolved in law, needing to be resolved in the hearts and minds of good people. Well, if we push this out in a broad way, let's say those were the types of discussion points that were really more interesting to these early Masonic ancestors. And that they became more aware of innovative thinkers and became interested in an opportunity to explore different cultures, different lifestyles, not in terms of judgment. How often do we see the petit bourgeois making judgments of each other, making judgments of our Grand Lodge? And I don't mean the pettiness of our own conceits. I mean, talking about fundamentals. One glib young customer of the craft talked about the assembly line of masonry. How clever. I thought that was enormously clever. There is not that many times when we can have an enjoyable conversation, a deep and thoughtful conversation, that we can afford to be smug about it, protect it. Now let's say those conversations went on, and between two fellows, they knew two other fellows, who knew two other fellows, who each knew two other fellows. And the camaraderie was always secondary to the point of getting together. In your work with your cronies, does having a good time ever replace the... Is that your employers all of a sudden begin to pay you for having a good time? Does that become the point of your labors, whether you're working in finance or you're a merchant of goods or you're an instructor? Or you're a protector? Does the good time then push aside the purpose for the gathering in the first instance? Examine 300 years of history, and it's easy to feel that generation to generation has lost track of the essence, the purpose of the craft. Only, not entirely, but enough that it's become, in a way, for a lot of men, a competing idea. And rightfully so. Rightfully so. Come here, the knife and fork Mason. Because a good conversation becomes cordial. Men exhibiting good manners and a state of deportment toward one another. Being able to relax in those circumstances. To examine ideas. Only the examination of the idea, that thoughtful conversation, began to be marginalized, somehow. And how would we ever know that? A thoughtful conversation today often brings out that stunned self-consciousness. Stunned self-consciousness. In which the schoolboy comes to the surface. The confusion becomes apparent. Where that need, the need to acquiesce to the person of greater influence in the room becomes the subtext. That grown men will stop thinking and talking because they're not sure of their place in the conversation. This is what we've become. How in the world did we let that happen? How? Great structure is necessary. It's important. Consistency. Predictability. It helps us to measure outcome, to have a sense out of the randomness of direction and purpose. That work, that essential work, is Grand Lodge, Grand Lodges, the protectors of our Constitution. Can Freemasonry be morphed into something uniform, where compliance becomes vital? Well, in some ways, you could see that if a group of men are doing things that embarrasses the very purpose and dignity of the order, then some type of correctional mechanism needs to be put in place, some type of sanction. What comes to my mind, laughingly, I know that others take them dreadfully seriously, but it was this bit of a gadfly, Aleister Crowley, sort of became an example. Some people actually made claim that he was the evilest man in the world. That would, I think, elevate a man somewhat irresponsible to a status he neither warranted or deserved or sought. It was a bit of a fool. There was nothing thoughtful there. He did nothing to damage something as significant as the contemplation of serious philosophical notion. Sensationalism always prevails, always. That dissenting opinion is prevalent. We turn, it's our nature as humans, to turn to the things that aren't there, to criticize, to look at the damage. It's within our nature to think about the accident, to think about the mistaken judgment. It's our nature, but it is not reality. In real terms, you have to ask yourself, answer it for yourself, is there a moral imperative in the universe? Well, maybe the answer for me is in this kind of a conversation. I was listening to a man sort of bragging to me that he could prove anything using statistics. How that comes into a conversation with me, those of you who know me can only shake your head. How? Okay. So he was out to demonstrate that all statistics are lies. Okay. And yet, what statistics gather is our progress. They're optimistic. They prove something in an optimistic frame. Oh, if you haven't studied statistics, I guess you've... then it's easy to say, well, you can prove anything you want with statistics. Well, in fact, why is the trend then of statistics to demonstrate progress? We gather information to answer questions. The nature of the question is about the impediments to a progress. How can we reduce them? How can we do things better? What does this information tell us about the world that we live in? Measures. You see, the vitality of the order rests on the pillars of a Grand Lodge. Now, I began to wonder if that was, in a sense, if there were other illusions created, in a sense, that the illusion of a banquet became the purpose for our Freemasonic gatherings. And that had an appeal. Well, nobody's ever saying, if you only want to have a good time and to be with in the company of a friendly crowd of men, and be identifiable and welcomed anywhere you are, where you meet each other, if that's for your purpose in becoming a Freemason, well, don't do it. Nobody would ever, in their right mind, would ever suggest such a thing. For those fellows, the order owed a responsibility to teach how that this process occurred and to enable them to also have the choice, another choice. Nobody's going to take that choice away. My goodness, there's enough suffering and pain in the world. The man relaxes, puts on a tuxedo and goes out and has a good meal and experiences a piece of ritual and is not curious beyond looking at how well the footwork is done or the memory work is done. If that's all it takes, without looking at whether the person, the speaker, has portrayed the character. And today, sadly, for a lot of us, do it in a hollow room where there isn't that even music, because don't you know a man's voice is the source of his own self-consciousness, and we wouldn't want to make him think about it, would we? No, we wouldn't want to do that. So we strip away the music. Nobody's going to say to the fellow, don't come because you want to do that. Find yourself in this kind of an atmosphere. This is a point where there's contemplation. And if you haven't been prepared, if you haven't been introduced to the idea of the question, then you may sit there rather than asking what the point is. The human mind will fill in the answer with whatever is at hand, whatever helps join the intellectual dots together. Right or wrong? I hardly think so. The undercurrent has always been the foundation. It's never wavered. Whether people get it or don't get it, what's to get about the point of universality or common good? What's to get about that? Well, argue about it. Debate it freely. Try not to make a fool of yourself. But the order is about enlightenment. That's the challenge. It's not about dogma. It's about rhetoric. Remember when it was taught in the universities, the art of persuasion. The debate isn't about what a man believes. It's about his skill at influencing other people's thinking, to make them believe what he is saying is their belief. So we have ideas. The ideas say very little about us. It's what we do with them. Now think about all of the censorship. Think about the censors out there that in their piety determined that we could not be experiencing certain ideas because the idea in their mind was wrong. I'll talk a little bit about, you know, ancient Christmases, just because we have Christmas coming up, and it illustrates that point rather well. The examination of any idea, whether it's consistent with our belief system, is wrong. Really? That certainly is not a Masonic belief. It may play well where we want to get through everything, not think too much, but get right to the banquet. Let's get right down to the fork and knife. All of that goes on. It's trivia, Masonic trivia. Nothing wrong with it. When I go to the theater, I don't think in my whole life I will ever enjoy the trip to the theater, the company of the people in the vehicle, more than the point of the play, the plot, the acting, the atmosphere. Can those people get me to believe them? That suspension of disbelief, as the dramatists would have us believe. Of course I'll like the comfortable ride. Of course I'll love your company. Of course we'll be cordial. But there is the point. If it's a bad play, I'll probably enjoy your company more than the bad play. It's a complicated world, isn't it? Here's a bit from Peer Gynt's Suite by Grieg. This is a incidental music to Henrik Ibsen's 1867 play. The play was called Peer Gynt. And this is a piece called Anitra's Dance. And it was written by the Norwegian composer Edvard Grieg in 1875. So we passed the premiere date. The anniversary of this is the 24th of February, 1876, in what was then called Christiania. And it's now Oslo. Peer Gynt Suite. Anitra's Dance. Thank you. extended. Oh, I understand that there's fans of AC/DC and Rolling Stones and Justin Bieber out there listening. And there's fans of Anya and Chuck Berry and Bill Evans. Everybody has their own tastes. We're okay with that. Don't expose me to barbershop music. It's an acquired taste. It's like, I can't quite handle that yet. I'm not that mature in my mind. I think the idea of the ideal mason, the true mason, came from some archetypes. And I wanted to, and I've been referring to this person's work, this man's work, for so long, I think I've forgotten to explain more about who he was, who he is. This is Michel de Montaigne, and he writes in One Question and 20 Attempts at an Answer. It goes something like this: the 21st century is full of people who are full of themselves. A half hour's troll through the online ocean of blogs, tweets, tubes, faces, spaces, pages, brings up thousands of individuals fascinated by their own personalities and shouting for attention. They go on about themselves, they diatrize and chat and upload photographs of everything they do. Ugh. Uninhibitedly extrovert, they also look inward as never before. Even as bloggers and networkers delve into their private experience, they communicate with their fellow humans in a shared festival of the self. Some optimists have tried to make this global meeting of the mind the basis for a new approach to international relations. The historian Theodore Zeldin has founded a site called the Oxford Muse, M-U-S-E. Check it out. Which encourages people to put together brief self-portraits in words, describing their everyday lives and the things they've learned. They upload these for other people to read and respond to. For Zeldin, shared self-revelation is the best way to develop trust and cooperation around the planet, replacing national stereotypes with real people. The great adventure of our epoch, he says, is to discover who inhabits the world, one individual at a time. The Oxford Muse is thus full of personal essays or interviews with titles like this: Why an Educated Russian Works as a Cleaner in Oxford. Why Being a Hairdresser Satisfies the Need for Perfection. How Writing a Self-Portrait Shows You Are Not Who You Thought You Were. What You Can Discover If You Do Not Drink or Dance. What a person adds when writing about himself to what he says in conversation. How to be successful and lazy at the same time. How a chef expresses his kindness. By describing what makes them different from anyone else, the contributors reveal that they share with everyone else the experience of being human. This idea, writing about oneself to create a mirror in which other people recognize their own humanity, has not existed forever. It had to be invented. And unlike many cultural inventions, it can be traced to a single person, Michel de Montaigne. He was a nobleman, a government official, and a wine grower who lived in the Perigord area of southwestern France from 1533 to 1592. Montaigne created the idea simply by doing it. Unlike most memoirists of his day, he did not write to record his own great deeds and achievements. And what good is he if he's not bragging about himself, or his accomplishments, or his ability to compete for experiences? I climbed the highest mountain. I climbed one higher. Nor did he lay down a straight eyewitness account of historical events, although he could have done. He lived through a religious civil war which almost destroyed his country over the decades he spent incubating and writing his book. A member of a generation robbed of the hopeful idealism enjoyed by his father's contemporaries, he adjusted to public miseries by focusing his attention on private life. He weathered the disorder, oversaw his estate, assessed court cases as a magistrate, and he administered Bordeaux as the most easygoing mayor in its history. And he wrote free-floating pieces, 107 essays, of cruelty, of names, how our mind hinders itself, of friendship, how we cry and laugh for the same thing, of diversion, of experience. They rarely offer to explain or teach anything. Montaigne presents himself as someone who jotted down what was ever going through his head when he picked up the pen, capturing encounters and states of mind as they happened. He used these experiences as the basis of asking himself questions. Above all, the big question that fascinated him, as it did many of his contemporaries: how to live. This is not the same as the ethical question, how should one live? Moral dilemmas interested Montaigne, but he was less interested in what people ought to do than in what they actually did. He wanted to know how to live a good life, meaning a correct or honorable life, but also a fully human, satisfying, flourishing one. This, for me, begins to penetrate the culture of Freemasonry, doesn't it? What do you think? This question drove him both to write and read, for he was curious about all human lives, past and present. He wondered constantly about the emotions and motives behind the people and what they did. And since he was the example closest to hand of a human going about its business, he wondered just as much about himself. Down-to-earth question, how to live. It splintered in a myriad of other pragmatic questions. Like everybody else, Montaigne ran up against the major perplexities of existence. How to cope with the fear of death, how to get over losing a child or a beloved one, how to reconcile yourself to failures, how to make the most of every moment so that life does not drain away unappreciated. But there were smaller puzzles too. How do you avoid being drawn into a pointless argument with your wife or a servant? How can you reassure a friend who thinks a witch has cast a spell on him? How do you cheer up a weeping neighbor? How do you guard your home? What is the best strategy if you are held up by armed robbers who seem to be uncertain whether to kill you or hold you to ransom? If you overhear your daughter's governess teaching her something you think is wrong, is it wise to intervene? How do you deal with a bully? What do you say to your dog when he wants to go out and play while you want to stay at your desk writing your book? In place of abstract answers, Montaigne tells us what he did in each case and what it felt like when he was doing it. He provides all the details we need to make it real, and sometimes more than we need. He tells us, for no particular reason, that the only fruit he likes is melon, that he prefers to have sex lying down rather than standing up, that he cannot sing, and that he loves vivacious company and often gets carried away by the spark of repartee. but he also describes sensations that are harder to capture in words, or even to be afraid of, to be aware of, what it feels like to be lazy, or courageous, or indecisive, or to indulge a moment of vanity, or to try to shake off an obsessive fear. He even writes about the sheer feeling of being alive. Exploring such phenomena over 20 years, Montaigne questioned himself again and again and built up a picture of himself, a self-portrait, in constant motion, so vivid that it practically gets up off the page and sits down next to you to read over your shoulder. He can say surprising things. A lot has changed since Montaigne was born, almost half a millennia ago, and neither manners nor beliefs are always still recognizable. Yet to read Montaigne is to experience a series of shocks of familiarity, which make the centuries between him and the 21st century reader collapse to nothing. Readers keep seeing themselves in him, just as visitors to the Oxford Mews see themselves or aspects of themselves in the story of why an educated Russian works as a cleaner or what it is like to prefer not to dance. Let me begin again the expose on this. Over the next holiday, the holiday period coming up, we'll talk more about Montaigne and his thoughts and revelations, and discover for ourselves what it teaches. Are the things that we're reading, the things that we're, the music that we listen, that we hear and enjoy, are they things that are enduring? Or will they be forgotten as something populist and trendy? Well, at least let's examine the question before we decide that everything should be pop psychology and pop music. Whatever possessed people to get into Freemasonry in the first place and develop it? Holy mackerel. Thank you. The inspiration for this piece of music that was first performed in 1875 was based on a poem by Henry Cazalès on an old French superstition. It went like this: zig, 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 death in a cadence, striking his heel a tune. Death at midnight plays a dance tune, zig, zig, zig on his violin. We'll go on. Imagine the audacity of somebody being inspired by a poem about an old French superstition. Can you imagine? Did it take less or more audacity for... I need to know, do you think that the Royal Society had an influence in what we did and what we became? Is it possible? You know, in that period, those 50, 60 years before, I was just speaking the other night with the grand historian, Michael Jenkins. Lively conversation is always such an incredibly engaging mind. And he's telling me about his research into some military groups here in Canada. As I listened to him, I began to realize that as we're looking for information, few people seem to be asking the questions. You know, we don't throw information at people that don't want it. We know that they want the information when it helps them to answer questions like Montaigne, how do you live? It's important if you're looking to answer the question, how do I live? Then it becomes really useful. How do I improve myself? Not what are we going to have to eat? Nothing wrong with that if you're hungry, is there? You might say. But you get what I mean. So were we an audacious group? What Brother Jenkins reminded me about was that, and that I went on to explain, was that he is writing material that will be searched out perhaps 25, 50, 100 years from now. If he doesn't do this, if he only based his work on the appeal and the reaction of brethren today, it might be discouraging. And he might lose interest. But the essence, the importance of what he's done will be known after his lifetime. And there will be that day when curious-minded Masons ask the question and begin to search for information. My goodness, that information needs to be there and not lost, wouldn't you say? He has a very strong and respectful relationship with the Grand Lodge of Newfoundland. And if you know anything about the Masons of the East Coast, they're well-schooled gentlemen, very well-schooled gentlemen. They know a considerable amount about the craft history. And of course, we would have Grand Lodge of Ireland, Grand Lodge of Scotland, having a part of the provenance of masonry in those areas. So, to be a repository for some of this information, it's not such a stretch. When curious minds begin to look for what he's producing, the papers that he's producing are they're phenomenal. But only to somebody that's curious enough to ask questions similar to the nature and point of the work that he's doing, they will be able to find them. Thank goodness. Now, we could exist and function as 21st century Masons without giving too much thought to the provenance of the order, except it's important if we're trying to understand where we are today. Need to have a bit of a sense of where we've been, which makes me more convinced that that we've established some of these events as our traditions. Events from the past become our traditions. And yet, I have to wonder, where has the vitality of the Royal Society gone? Or has it gone anywhere? Perhaps it was, like a lot of good ideas, a flashpoint in time, not intended to exist, never with a craving to exist for its own sake, but to exist as long as it served purpose. Now, the Royal Society continues to this day, has a branch here in Toronto, the original in London. It has a life of its own. It wasn't necessarily infused with Masons, but there were people there that were curious and felt that the Masonic order at the time was able to answer questions for them. Just like I would say that today, amongst all of the people coming in to the order, all of the good people coming into the order, there are true Masons. Who, true, because they've discovered within themselves that nature. They've been able, through Masonry, to begin to understand themselves in a cultural reference and understand the principles and ethics that support the culture and the beliefs that we hold as a parent. It is what it is. Gentlemen, it's within the framework of Grand Lodge. More so that Masonry exists inside you and inside your mind. And it has a leg up through the work of the support of our Grand Lodges to bring forward history. It's not just that. It's a vehicle for us to find answers to the essential questions. It doesn't necessarily make that easy. We have work to do. Here's something Prokofiev. I've always liked it, and it sort of gets me in that Christmassy frame of mind. I'm not going to get into more of the Royal Society. I think we've had enough. Decide for yourself, read for yourself. A book my daughter gave me, I think I'll give you the title here. It's called Freemasonry and the Birth of Modern Science. And it's by one of those notorious writers, Robert Lomas. You remember his work with Bajan? They were sort of the novels of brought a lot of us into Masonic history. Bajan passed away, sadly. It was an interesting collaboration between these two. But Robert Lomas seems to have revealed a very scholarly, intense mind and an ability. It's wonderful. I find this, and I have it on my shelf that I refer to repeatedly, because it is, I find it one of those, the Royal Society for me is one of the icons of Masonic development in Britain. And then I'm reminded that Masonry existed hundreds of years before Grand Lodge was considered, which should compel us to be curious and find what was going on and how and why, and really wonder if you're not part of that same mentality today. This is Peter the Wolf. Something about the ancient fairy tales. They're very, very frank. That was before the time when we had, when cultures had classified children as pretty useless. There was a period in the history of mankind when there was no distinction between child and adult. Industrial Revolution really made hay of that, the children being working in unimaginable conditions in the mines and in mills, and to this day, even in this country, we have small children as young as 8 years old working in the fields in Alberta on farms, and within the framework of old law. Curious times we live in, isn't it? Are you prepared? Get prepared for this. Here's this is something that I may just put this off. This is a history of the 12 days of the Christmas. A little something for you. This is I'll just leave you with this. This is a Gaelic traditional song. It's an old, one of the old Christmas carols of Scotland, and this is by Fiona McKenzie. I think you'll like it. And I look forward, thank you for tuning in. I look forward to all of you coming back next week. Take care of yourself. Get ready for the snow. Cheers.